And just a reminder, guys, everybody, without this being said, we know everybody, once they become part of the mastermind group, everybody signs an NDA. So hopefully this private information doesn't make it outside of this training call. Just wanted to mention that. I know you guys are all stand-up people and aren't going to be doing that. So these are actual borrowers. So as he goes through this, I'm excited. So.
Okay, well.
Go ahead, sir.
All right. So these are files that we have an agreement in principle to purchase. There's about 138, maybe 140 that we're going to be closing on Friday. And I thought it might be helpful for you guys to see a little bit about what it is that we look at and what helps make your buying decision, especially in the context where there's a lot of information that could dissuade somebody from making a purchase. They see, you know, this or that problem, and it looks like a bigger problem than it might actually be, things like that. So if everybody can hear me okay, I'll just keep going, and if there's a problem, Travis, let me know.
I will. Everyone's tuned in, and no problems.
All right. So here's a little list of things that I always look for whenever I'm doing my homework on any kind of a deal. All of this information right here is from the origination file. We want to know when it was originated and also when it was funded. And you're going to have to forgive me, some of this can be very tedious, but I'll try and get through it as quick as I can. The reason these two fields are separate is because a transaction type can be different. A purchase funds the same day or the next day. A refinance of a loan has a rescission period. And many times when I'm looking at files, if these two dates are different, it's an instant tip that there could be something possibly fraudulent or deficient about the file. I look at the original balance versus the current balance. I look at when the first payment was due, when the next payment was due, meaning what their current due date is, and when the last time they actually paid was. The reason these two dates are important is because you, like for example, in this tape that we just bid, there were a couple of files that said they were current. So this next payment due date said August 1 of 2015. The problem was they'd never made a payment. And so that instantly tips us off to look somewhere else to see why that's the situation. And we'll probably get into one or two of those specific files a little bit later. Obviously, we're going to look at the original P&I payment. We're going to look at the current P&I payment. What we're looking for here are the differences. If there's a distinct difference, if it's a huge difference, if it's a little difference, if there's no difference. And that's important because it can be a quick tip as to whether or not the file's been modified. It can also be a tip as to...
Sorry to interrupt you real quick. It looks like, can I just have people type in the question box, make sure they're seeing Philip's screen? A couple of people said they're still seeing the PPM member training page. Can everyone see Philip's screen? Sorry to interrupt you.
No, that's okay.
But I think it should be okay. All right, sorry about that. So, yeah, it looks like everyone can see it.
Okay.
Go ahead.
All right. So, and then we have the original interest rate versus the current interest rate. And we're looking again for a difference or a distinction between these two. It can, a large difference could point to a modification. It could also point to an ARM loan, an adjustable rate mortgage. And those things are important to know because sometimes you don't have a collateral file. Sometimes you don't have a note to go back on, and you want to, these things are building the story. We want to know the loan term. Is it a straight 360 months? A balloon indicator. There's a huge market right now. In fact, we've got a number of them in this trade where borrowers say that they were not aware it was a balloon note. And the reason that they say they weren't aware is because the loan was amortized over 360 months, but it's really due in 180, or it's really due in 120. And they say that they were caught unawares. So I'm looking for the amortization term in terms of months, 180, 360, whatever it may be. I want to know the original maturity date of the original note. And keep in mind, we're only talking about the original stuff, not the stuff you're dealing with currently, but this is where you start. Our loan status, are we delinquent? Are we in foreclosure? We kicked six files from this trade because the seller wasn't even aware that six of their own loans had been foreclosed and sold as REOs. They had already been liquidated. They had no idea because they weren't paying attention. So this loan status, huge. We had a number of them where they were in bankruptcy, and because of a communication gap between the servicer and the seller, they weren't aware of a certain bankruptcy issue. The loan type, is it a cash out refi? Is it a purchase? Is it a consolidation refi, a construction to perm loan? What were we going to do with the money? What lien position are we in? Is there an escrow element? Can we verify it by the cash flow and the payment application? Do we have a positive escrow balance, meaning are there surplus funds sitting in the escrow element of their account that could be used to pay taxes and insurance as they come due? Is there a negative escrow balance, meaning the servicer has had to pay out money to protect their interest by paying the taxes, by paying the insurance? Those funds get applied to the borrower's account. The borrower owes that money to you if you purchase this loan, so you want to know what the negative escrow balance is. Your current PITI, principal interest, taxes and insurance, the full payment, the full cash amount you should be receiving every month. Anything sitting in suspense, the unapplied balances. Sometimes you'll have a situation where the borrower is on a trial modification or they're on a repayment plan, and they're paying you or they're paying the prior servicer amounts that are not sufficient to roll a due date. And so the servicer will aggregate those payments until there is enough money to roll a due date, and then they'll take it all out of suspense, out of this bucket here, and they'll apply it. A corporate advance balance. That is money that is owed to the servicer by the borrower for things like property inspections or bankruptcy or foreclosure costs or things like that. Those are funds that the servicer has put out that they need to reclaim. So when we get to the ARM info, if you have an ARM loan, this is hugely important to understand. We don't see a lot of them, and particularly not on this pool because these are all seconds that are very straightforward. There weren't any ARMs in this one. But all of this ARM language is very important to understand, and if you don't, this conversation about this bucket right here is probably a good half hour on its own. I'll be happy to answer any specific questions that somebody might have right now, but otherwise I'd probably prefer to skip this section just because it doesn't necessarily apply to what we're trying to do today. So Travis, let me know if somebody raises their hand and with a specific
question. We have some good questions coming
okay.
here. So
let's have them.
Alan asks, what do you do about the balloon unaware status? Is this lawsuit material? Follow up with that or anything, Alan, if I missed anything. Hold on. He just actually said, correction, is the balloon issue going to be the subject of a lawsuit is his question. Sorry, here's it.
Well, the answer is yes and no. Anybody can sue for any reason. The balloon might just happen to be what they choose because it's their only possible defense. It doesn't stand up, however. Balloons have held up over and over and over and over. A balloon is in your favor. If somebody says they don't have a balloon, what they're saying is, or if somebody says, I have a balloon and I was unaware, what they're really saying to you is, can you help me? Let's make a deal. So if you get a balloon note and you can establish communication, that is a tremendous, tremendous benefit. Do we have any others on that one?
Yep. No, thanks for that. There's one more. Just, is there a better resource for checking foreclosures on the first than CoreLogic? We checked ours, but have found from attorneys that first have been in foreclosure for a while, but not reflected on CoreLogic.
Well, when they're saying CoreLogic, are they meaning RealQuest, which is a service provided, or are they talking about ordering lien reports from CoreLogic? Because those are a couple different things.
Go ahead and type that in, Melanie, and just give us the update to what Erin asked, and we'll come back to you. Oh, she's saying RealQuest. Yeah, she's saying RealQuest on that.
That's not always the most accurate. It's a resource we recommend, and and unfortunately, it doesn't always provide up to date or even older data. So that's why we order, different lien reports or TLO reports and other stuff.
Right. So one thing that can be very tricky when you're doing due diligence is to make the assumption that any one piece of data is telling you the entire story. That's just not the case. Even in the pool that we just purchased, we've got files that look like they've been in foreclosure for 5 years, and it's not the case. And so you can't look at that one piece of data, even from a vendor, and because that's where we got the information as well, with the vendor whose job it is to provide specific information about foreclosure status. But you got to remember, they're aggregating data from the same sources that you would be able to go get it from, and typically those folks are very low paid, line level staff. It's fraught with wide variances in accuracy, and that's why a loan level review is so important, because you're going to be able to get the entire story, the full context, without relying or being misled by one or two pieces of data. And in fact, Aaron and I were talking just this morning. We had a file that we were going to kick from the pool because it didn't look right. It looked like it had been stripped in the bankruptcy, and it looked like there hadn't been any payments for 10 months. But when I asked one or two specific questions, it prompted him to get the servicer on the phone, and lo and behold, we've got a fully cash-flowing lien that we're paying very little money for, that we now have a trustee's disbursement report showing that we're going to get paid almost six times the amount we paid for the loan over the next 5 years. And so you can't rely on that one particular piece of data. Make sure you're asking everything and drawing no conclusions until your full review is done. There's very few times when one or two pieces of data stop your review. One of those times will be, if you see that it's been foreclosed and liquidated, there's probably not a lot of point in moving forward at that point. Validate that information. But other than that, there's just not that many situations where one piece of information or two is going to change what you're doing, especially in a bankruptcy situation, because they're very complicated. So as we move on to this ARM info, is there any questions specifically about this stuff here?
I do have a question on the ARM here. Gary says, what's the pro and con to having an ARM in your pool, and what's the top items to be focused on for an ARM?
The pro would be it's typically very negotiable. People don't like the ARMs that they're on. The con could be if it's a recent ARM, the interest rate is already extremely low, and you might not have a lot of wiggle room to negotiate even further. People don't like ARMs. They historically, the rates only go up. That's not true in the last couple of adjustments. They have been going down. But it's much like a balloon. It's a very negotiable piece of information that favors you.
Very good. There's also a resource here. John Costigan shared it with us. Title 365 has a wonderful product for title info. That's actually a referral we were given. We'll vet it out as well, but just an FYI. So thanks, John. Keep rolling, Philip.
So the next thing that I would look at is I would go and I would dig into my collateral itself. I would go, typically, you know, you'll have digital images. You might even have boxes of physical files with original signatures and things like that. And I'm looking for what I have, my document type. Is it an original? If it is required to be recorded, is it recorded, or is it a copy of a recorded document? And I want to make sure that I understand that I know what collateral documents I have. Is my note a copy? Is my mortgage recorded? Is my policy, is it a commitment only? You know, I've seen collateral files that have closing protection letters in there, and those have nothing to do with the collateral. That's for the lender. Or is it a full policy? Is it a short form policy, which is just as valid? Who is the original lender on the deed? Who is the senior lien holder, if there is one? Do you have, is your deed recorded in the name of MERS? And if so, who's your payee? What's your MERS MIN number? And those are, you know, some of the most important things you can understand is, do you have the real documents? Because that's going to be one of the first and one of the most common defenses that you have in the seconds world is, well, you don't have a note. You don't own this loan. And, you know, a number of years ago, we went through a big phase with frivolous disputes that had to actually end up in the hands of the court to determine whether or not they really had to be answered. And the original documentation was part of that frivolous dispute package. Now, if you have a copy of a note and you got an assignment, that's all you need. If you have an affidavit, a lost note affidavit that says the note is gone, but here's a copy of it, and here's an affidavit that says it once existed, that also is all you need. So then I go to my borrower. And again, we're talking about origination information. And I understand the full context. How old are they is important. Are they 20 and, you know, dad gave them a bunch of money? Are they 85 and their kids are taking advantage of them? Are they gainfully employed? What do they do? How long have they done it? Is it a new job? Is it a new career? Were they an astronaut for 20 years and now they're a code writer? Or were they claiming to be a, you know, a trash collector making, you know, $600,000 a year? Those things are all very important to understand as you're looking through what's happening. The old versus the new housing expense is very, very important to understand what happened in that transaction. You might have somebody that took $300,000 in cash out and tripled their house payment and became a first payment default. Well, obviously that's fraud, right? So was it a purchase? If so, how much was the purchase? How much did they put down? If it was a refi, how much did they cash out? If it was a refi, how many years did they own the property before they refied it? That's important to know because you'll see files where they bought it and 3 months later they had their buddy, the loan broker, refi it and you know, inflate the equity and give them a bunch of cash. Original occupancy is very important. Was it an investor property, a second home, or a primary residence? And this comes up frequently when you're reviewing the notes or when you're talking to the borrower because they'll frequently tip their hand. This is, you know, for those who may not be totally familiar with origination, there's a big benefit to originating your mortgage as owner-occupied. It's less expensive, the underwriting is easier, there's less money down. So this was one of the most common ways that people committed what they felt to be minor harmless fraud, but in fact is pretty significant fraud. What was their debt-to-income ratio? You know, what was their credit score at the time? What was the level of documentation that was required to get this loan? Was it a full doc? Was it an FHA? Was it a streamline that didn't require an appraisal? Was it a no doc, no assets, no income, nothing verified? what did they do with the money here under benefit? Did they cash it out? Were they consolidating? If you're in a first situation, is there a second behind you? And if so, how much? And when did it show up? And why? Did it show up at origination as a standalone second as part of an 80-20 purchase situation, or where did it come from? Did they sign an application? Do you have a copy of it? Did they sign a truth in lending? Not an initial truth in lending, but a final truth in lending. One, you know, within 3 days of the closing. Did they sign a HUD-1 settlement statement? They don't have to sign it in every state, but you should have a copy of it so that you can see what happened in the transaction. Were they able, this ROR stands for right of rescission. Were they provided an opportunity to cancel the transaction if the law required it? Was it required, yes or no? Did each borrower sign it, yes or no? And what were the dates? And now we're getting into more of the numbers stuff, you know. Is there a copy of the appraisal in the file? Was it an interior or an exterior or a drive-by inspection? And you hear the word appraisal and you instantly think interior, but that's not always the case, especially in some government loans. They can do an exterior-only appraisal. Does the appraisal note any environmental issues? What did they value the appraisal at? What kind of property do you have? Is it a fourplex? Is it a duplex? Is it a Baltimore row house? Is it a single-family residence? Is it a homestead in Texas? This is very, very important to know. It's probably one of the most important pieces of information on the appraisal is your type. How many units do you have? What's the condition? Condition types on an appraisal are typically fair, average, or good. And this is the appraiser's opinion. And most commonly, you'll just see average. If it's standing and it looks like it's not going to fall over, it's probably average condition. Location, this is not an opinion as to whether or not it is in a good location. This is a data point referring to, is it suburban or rural or urban? When was it built? How many beds, how many baths, how many square footage? Does it have a garage? Is it a standalone garage? Is it an attached garage? Is it a carport? Is it a condo and they have an assigned parking space? How big is the lot? And is there anything else that you need to know about?
Philip, can I interject something real quick on a question we just got? And this would be a good talking point. And so Melanie was asking, you know, did I miss how we get this info? Usually this info isn't in a, quote, normal collateral package. So I'd like to address it from the standpoint of a couple things. One is, you know, what is considered normal, you know, and two is, you know, on this particular trade, we always ask for the world up front, and sometimes, you know, we get some and then go back and we get a little bit more. Can you kind of walk through the process of, you know, getting information, getting more information as the, you know, time and seriousness progresses, and just kind of walk from that? Really, we need to walk it through the angle of, you know, if people are buying 100, 200, 300K, you know, types of fundings versus buying, you know, like 200 loans.
First and foremost,
is that what you're gonna ask, Travis?
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah. First and foremost, ask for the information. If you're buying, you know, a small unit count, one to five loans, you might have to ask more than once because it takes, you know, it takes almost the same amount of time for somebody to provide, you know, 100 docs as it does, or to request 100 docs as it does to request 5 docs. And you know, there's a mindset that, oh man, somebody's buying 3 to 5 loans, they're going to pepper me with questions. Well, you're dang right, and you should. This is a financial transaction. You should not ever hesitate to ask for the information you need to make the right decision, because you don't want to look like a novice or you don't want to pester somebody. I mean, Aaron, what time did I get on the phone with these guys this morning? 6 o'clock?
6 a.m. and I went to bed at 2, and I went to bed at 2 a.m.
Right. And I pestered them for another 5 hours today. And I'm not talking 6 o'clock my time. I'm talking 6 o'clock their time. I had them on the phone. You just have to ask the questions. It's not – so if you get any pushback as to, well, we don't have that, that's not a good enough answer. Ask the question, where is it? Where did it go? Who serviced it last? Who was the collateral file released to? Do you have a copy of the Bailey letter where they sent the collateral to that servicer? You've got to make them dig. You've got to make them feel a little pain. And the reason those questions work is because now you're no longer asking about a copy of the appraisal, okay? Now you're asking questions that are going to take more time for them to resolve than just providing the appraisal. Does that make sense? So you want to ask those questions, and if you need to write them down, do it. Ask, where did the collateral file go? Has it ever been in your possession? Who was supposed to release it to you? Who had it last? Was there a Bailey letter, and do you have a copy of it? Those questions will typically, you know, if they really don't have it, if it was really gone, then the, you know, the biggest question is, okay, can you recreate the collateral file for me? Because you can ask them to recreate the collateral file based on their images. But guess what? It's going to be easier for them to just send you the images. So don't ever hesitate to ask. I understand that sometimes, and I've heard it a couple of different times, that people feel like it's not part of a typical collateral file, and maybe it's not, but it also may be because you didn't know to ask. We asked a ton of questions this morning and came out way, way, way ahead on this deal because we knew what to ask and we weren't afraid to do it. And that's all you've got to do. If they really, really, really don't have it, that's one thing. But nobody, they don't want to sit and lie to you about it either. They don't want to tell you that they don't because they're being lazy. Let's see. Probably won't be dealing with a lot of loans or files that have active mortgage insurance on them. Typically, they're canceled by the time they hit the secondary market. Same with FHA. But your loss mitigation activity, this is hugely, hugely important. This can tell you what kind of efforts have been made, what kind of negotiations they've had, how sincerely they treated those negotiations. If you're able to get, and you should be able to, but when you get your loss servicing notes, you'll see, you know, if they tried to sell the property, you'll see the listing history. If they tried to present a short sale, you'll see any offers that may have come in. You'll see who the realtor was. You'll see who the offer was from. And this is all hugely important because it can tell you if there's something wrong with your property physically that you're not aware of. That obviously the seller isn't just going to, you know, turn up and go, hey, there's a smoking hole in the backyard. We don't know what it is, but we hope it's not dangerous. Do you want to still buy our loan? They're not going to tell you that. They're not obligated to volunteer anything. It's your obligation to discover. And so that's why reviewing the loss mitigation history can be valuable. Reviewing the appraisal can be valuable, especially in a scenario where your appraisal noted that there was nothing wrong, but you couldn't sell it because, I don't know, the carport burned down or something like that. So I want to know all of those things. I especially want to understand any modifications, and almost every file in our pool that we just bought has been modified. And files get modified in a number of different ways. So, for example, on this particular trade, it was represented to us that a certain that certain files were performing and were great, and they'd always been that way, which was true based on that limited piece of information. But the context of these seconds, of these few loans, was that they were carved out of the original first. So the borrower had a $100,000 first. The servicer gave them a limited window of time to refinance their first, and they would discount the second and subordinate a new note behind whatever first they were able to obtain. And that's a little bit different than a typical loss mitigation hardship mod. That tells more of the story. And to me, that tells me those people are not going to default because, yeah, they've been paying this entire time, but a borrower doesn't look at a first and a second that was carved out that way the same way you or I would. To them, it's all the same loan because they're paying it to the same people. So to them, there's not that big of a distinction psychologically. And that's important for me to know, to understand the source of that modification, because it helps me understand where the borrower is going to go on those particular loans. And that was a pretty big revelation to see when I started pulling open files and seeing subordination agreements. Then I can go back and say, where'd these come from? You know, why in the world did we have to have a subordination agreement in the first place for this? And that's when I got the full story.
Sure. Quick question there, Philip, on FB info and what that is. I'm assuming that's forbearance, right?
Forbearance info, yes. And understand
forbearance info.
A forbearance, for those who are not familiar, is different than a modification. A forbearance is a short-term plan to get the borrower to either provide them time or provide them temporary payment relief. Let's say that they were really in default, but they found a great job. It doesn't start for 60 days, and they've got to move to California. And then their first paycheck, you know, obviously won't be for 3 weeks. They might need 90 days. But if they can prove that that's really the scenario, a servicer might put them on a forbearance plan, reduce their payment amount, put those payments in suspense while the borrower is, you know, moving to California or whatever. And then when they emerge from that forbearance plan, typically 90 days or whatever, there should be an exit strategy. Okay, what are we doing now? And so I want to know, is it active? Was it canceled because they failed to pay? When did it start? When did it end? How much was the new payment amount? On what day was it due? Sometimes they'll change a due date in a short-term forbearance plan to make the borrower's pay dates from their job and their due dates on the loan more consistent with each other, more compatible with each other. But they don't actually change the due date of the note. It's just a short-term relief thing, and that's why the due date matters. How much did they have to put down? That's extraordinarily relevant. If the borrower put nothing down, then you know there's very little value in the plan. And usually if I'm populating this field with a zero, I'm populating this field here with a number greater than one. Because if they're not putting anything down, it's very, very common to see them go through forbearance plan after forbearance plan over and over and over. Did I answer all the questions on that one?
Yeah, that's good. That's really good. A couple comments here, and I know we bought both firsts and seconds, non-performing, some re-performing, but the majority have been non-performing, and the majority of the loans we bought from a seller that did not have a whole lot of any of
it.
Yeah, let's talk about that, because like, this has been a real interesting experience to see how much information is at our fingertips working with a direct source.
Let's bring up a few clarifying questions so that we make sure we're all on the same page here. So, you know, Philip was talking about spent 5 hours this morning. I don't want to allude to the fact that you're going to hop on the phone with the seller and spend 5 hours with them if you're only buying 5 or 10 loans.
Right.
The reason we hopped on the phone with them and we got that consideration is because this is a multi-million dollar transaction we're doing with funding that takes place on Friday, where time is of the essence, and there were a handful of files that we were in dispute with them on. So that we had certain findings, and thus our pricing reflected as such, and they came back and were like, they were not happy. And so we're like, well, here's what we're finding, prove it's wrong, and going back and forth. Now, here's what I will say. That doesn't mean that you can't go back to the seller and be like, I found this, this, and this, therefore, you know, I don't want this, or, you know, I need more information on this. Can you provide this? But as far as, you know, going loan by loan by loan with some of that, I would not consider that to be realistic or, you know, a good business practice by, you know, for the with the seller and something that, quite frankly, you as the investor in due diligence would be responsible for and going through. So just want to give that context. There's another comment that was made of, you know, this is assuming that, you know, we're asking, you know, all these questions and collateral files and requesting servicing notes and everything else. And so one of the things that we've decided to do as a business decision is that we're only buying loans when this information is readily available at some point prior to funding. And that's a business decision. We would recommend it, but that's totally your call. As Travis mentioned, we bought from other sellers where this wasn't the case, and that caused issues within our business as a result of that. And so all good questions, and hopefully it brings it into good context for everyone on the call.
Well, I appreciate that. That's point well taken sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, if you could comment on that, Philip, because I know you've seen REO portfolios, non-performing first, performing first, performing seconds, non-performing seconds. Is there, when it comes to your non-performing portfolios, is there typically as much information on non-performing second portfolios as a rule of thumb that there is available on the non-performing first?
Not really. It's pretty rare to end up with files where there just isn't anything available. And to Aaron's point, if that really were the case, I wouldn't be buying them. And the reason I wouldn't buy them is because that's not the only deal out there. There's way too many deals to take that big of a risk. And Aaron's point was well taken. You're not going to be spending 5 hours on a call. My point in that illustration was, don't be afraid to ask the questions until you get the information. And it just happened to take us in that context, in that scenario. It was pretty unusual, but it did have to do with the transaction type as well. You're not going to have to spend a lot of time on the phone with your seller if they're providing you what you're asking for up front. So,
great comment. Why don't we just knock out this other question while we're here. This is from Gary. Another company that works in the second NPN space doesn't do modification or forbearance. They have a signed, quote, workout plan, unquote, close quote, with a borrower that reverts to the original note and deed of trust if they don't perform on the, quote, workout. What are your thoughts on that? And I know we've got mods that revert back, but they actually say forbearance / modification agreement at the top of the agreement. They don't say workout agreement. What are your thoughts?
It's just a strategy type. Mods come in all shapes and sizes. There's not one size fits all. I've seen mods where, let's say on a first, let's say they'll defer $50,000 of it, of the $100,000 that's due. And they'll make payments on the remaining $50,000. And as long as they make 5 years worth of payments, that other $50,000 goes away and it becomes permanent. But if they fail, it becomes part of it. Or if they sell the property, it becomes part of it or whatever. So because you own the paper, you can modify things however it's going to benefit the borrower in terms of providing genuine, sincere relief and assistance and still meet your financial objectives. I mean, you can modify them pretty much to whatever fits. And so a workout strategy like that, you know, that doesn't surprise me at all, and it's not really a big deal one way or the other.
So just a different label put on the top of the agreement, there's accomplishes the same end.
Yes.
And it's pretty common from what I've seen on a lot of the modification agreements where they do revert back to the original note and deed of trust, but they don't perform. Is that right?
Yeah, but that's not because of anything the borrower's doing. It's because typically the terms of the note, you know, they're in a trust somewhere, and people have gone out and purchased against it as a bond, and so the trust is responsible to make those bond payments. So while they're willing to make a concession for a performing note, the minute it becomes delinquent again, they're going to get everything that they should get. Because if there's equity in the property and they have to foreclose and reclaim that, you know, they're not going to bid against themselves by only trying to foreclose on the amount that they modified the note to. Does that make sense?
Yep. So question for you guys, just to check in with you, you attendees on the call here, are there a few more fields that you guys are seeing that might make a difference in helping you just get a better grasp for the overall picture of what's going on with your borrower? Maybe just type it in there, because I know for me, I was like, wow, I thought we gathered a lot of data, you know, so that I was excited to see a lot of things. It looks like we're still going, so keep it going, Philip.
Well, so if we want a shortcut to that, this here is the field that tells me what's really going on with the bar.
Well, go back. Can you go back just really quick on what you had there and just,
sure.
I think we missed just those bottom two categories, right, on that previous sheet you were on?
On the categories here, so we have...
Yeah, because I think it was short sellers below that. You had your BK screen.
Mm-hmm.
So we just said, okay.
Foreclosure information here, bankruptcy information here. We're buying a few files that are in foreclosure. And we're going to need to know everything about the foreclosure that we can know before we close the deal. Sometimes you'll know very little. Sometimes... You know, if you're provided enough information, you'll know quite a bit. Most importantly, the status. And there's more than one status. There's more than active and more than non-active. You could have a contested foreclosure. You could have a active foreclosure that is on hold for any number of reasons. So if you look at the status hierarchy, you would start with active, and then underneath active, you would have, you know, active but on hold. And then your hold reasons, and that is an industry term, your hold reasons include loss mitigation, state legislation holds, investor holds, where the bank or the servicer has simply said, put this file on hold. We're not going to move forward, and we're also not going to tell you why we're putting it on hold. Usually that's because they're getting ready to sell it. Understanding why it's on hold is very important, especially because in many states you can't leave it on hold indefinitely. It'll get kicked for lack of prosecution. You'll have to start all over, and that can be very expensive. So you want to know, when did it go to the foreclosure? And when did he do anything about it? When did he or she file the complaint first? Was there a huge amount of time between these two dates? Typically, it's 2 or 3 days. If they're on the stick, it doesn't take long. When did the borrower get served? And in the states where a judgment has to be entered before it can go to sale, when was that judgment date entered? And you're going to have the widest range of dates between this date and this date, and it can be years in some cases. Some states require you to go to mediation before you'll ever get a judgment, and a mediation is where your representative and the borrower literally meet in a room or on a conference call, and you hash it out, and they tell you all the reasons that they need help or all the reasons they're going to give you the bird, and you listen, and then you try and provide some solutions that will get the file cash flowing again. And I've seen lots of mediations where, because the borrower was difficult to deal with or borrower's counsel was difficult to deal with, the seller walked away from the table all bent out of shape and didn't make an offer that was reasonable, trying to prove their point instead of trying to get money. And that's the whole point of the mediation, is to defray and prevent that type of decision making, because it doesn't do anybody any good to not have the borrower paying if they have the ability to pay. Your judgment date to your foreclosure sale date, that can also be quite long. Different states have pre-sale redemption periods of 6 months. Did it sell to a third party? Or did it revert back to the bank? And if so, how much did the bank bid to get it back for? That's important to know, because sometimes a bank will bid $1 at the sale because they don't want the property. They want a third party to come buy it. And if they bid $1 and they end up with the property, that tells you you need to look a little bit different and a little bit deeper in the file to understand why that would be the case. When does your redemption expire? After the sale. You know, you've got states where it goes to sale and you've got a certificate of sale, but you're not going to get to do anything for another 6 months. So you want to know what that redemption expiration date is. And if you can find out who the attorney is, that's very helpful too. So the bankruptcy, this is really where we made our money this morning. So I don't know how many of the folks on the call are familiar with bankruptcy, and I hope I'm not, you know, explaining things that are elementary to some. But bankruptcies, they can be very complicated. We found a number of files where the lien had been stripped. And what that means is, it can mean two things. It can mean you're never getting paid, or it could mean you're going to be paid in part, or it could mean that you're going to be paid temporarily. And then, so let me give you an example. So a bankruptcy chapter 13, when somebody wants to strip the lien, they typically have to file a couple of motions. One, a motion to value the collateral, and sometimes they'll have to file an adversary proceeding to avoid your lien. And an adversary proceeding in a bankruptcy gets its own case number. It's a different case number than the actual parent bankruptcy. And the servicer that we were dealing with this morning, for whatever reason, had not recorded any of the adversary proceedings on some of their files, and were not aware of some of these things because they weren't looking for that chapter, or not the chapter, but they weren't looking for the right case number. So somebody files an adversary proceeding, and they're telling the court, I want to avoid this $20,000 lien because I already owe $100,000 to the first, and I'm alleging that the property is only worth $75,000. So not only can I not pay the first, there's no way I can pay the second. And they ask the court to make a ruling and, you know, and avoid the lien, and they can do that. Now, sometimes you can agree to what we call a stipulated agreement. And a stipulated agreement means, okay, we both know that maybe the property is upside down, but we both know that you're a debtor of upstanding morals and have an active conscience, and you have no intention of defaulting on this if you don't have to. So you're going to agree to pay me, let's say you owe me $250 a month. You're going to pay me $150 a month, every month, through the bankruptcy, through the trustee, and I'm going to get all that money. And then at the end, if you have successfully completed your Chapter 13 bankruptcy, then my lien becomes voided. If you see a scenario like that, that is to your benefit because it's guaranteed cash. But also, what happens if they get 4.5 years into the plan and default? What do you think has happened to their property value between now and 3 or 4 years down the line? Maybe it's stagnant. It's possible that it could have dropped, but we've been on a rebound, and it's not a dramatic rebound, but it's a consistent rebound. So even though today you may be neutral or even upside down, you're getting the benefit of a fixed cash flow and possible appreciation in the case of a default. They fall out of bankruptcy 13 in a couple of years. Well, your lien is still in place, plus you've already collected all that cash. So that's a very important one to understand, is what the status actually is. You have to understand that deadlines in a bankruptcy are very, very serious. I came across a number of files where the servicer lost their lien simply because they didn't respond in time. Their processes were not sufficient to capture the information and not quick enough to process the response, and they simply lost out. I want to know how many times they have filed, and that's hugely important. Aaron, if you recall, I was sharing with you last night, I've got a bunch of debtors that we were able to kick, and part of the reason that we knew to try and kick them was because they have filed bankruptcy like clockwork every 4 to 5 years. Didn't matter. I mean, going all the way back. So I want to know how many times they filed, what did they file, and what was the final disposition of each of those filings. As far as the current one, when did they file? What chapter? What was the case number? The chapter is important. Not too many people get to go straight to a 7 anymore, but it's very common to see a 13 convert to a 7. And that is a notice that you have to receive. They have to notify you and serve you that they're trying to convert that case to a 7 because that severely impacts your rights. Post-petition due date, and we covered this in the last symposium, but I don't know if everybody on the call was there. I'll try and cover it really quickly. The date that somebody files bankruptcy is called the petition date. They're petitioning the court for bankruptcy protection, so they file on May 1. Everything after May 1, all those payments that come after that date are called post-petition dates. They have to continue to make those payments afterwards, and the bankruptcy plan will pay out all of the pre-petition arrearages. They were $10,000 behind in payments when they filed bankruptcy on May 1. That $10,000 is going to be paid through the bankruptcy plan, but all the payments that come due after May 1, they have to continue to pay directly in most cases. Sometimes the trustee will do it, but in most cases, they have to continue to pay you. So that post-petition due date is very important because if they filed May 1 and they're still due for May 1 and it's now September, you've got a problem. Your proof of claim filing date. You've got to prove to the court that they owe you the money. You have to file a proof of claim. Your proof of claim will consist of everything that they owe you, including all of your arrearages, and you have to file it within a certain time frame. So what was the date that you filed? How much did you claim? If you have to file for relief, meaning let's say you own a property, this would be a most common scenario. You own a property, or sorry, you own a note on which there is equity even after the first and second are combined. They are paying on the first, they're not paying on the second. You can file for relief, get removed from the bankruptcy protection, and start your foreclosure. And so you're going to want to know when you filed for your relief, because many times this will trigger an answer from the borrower, or it could trigger another series of bankruptcy activities, and that filing date becomes relevant. When did you get the relief? And when was it released out of bankruptcy protection in your favor? Sometimes a bankruptcy may have ended, but the trustee hasn't yet released it because there's other creditors that still have to be paid, or whatever the case may be. Just because you get relief, most commonly you're free to go, but sometimes you're not. Sometimes you still have to wait. It's just that you can then move forward once they give you permission. REO, any questions on bankruptcy? I tried to cover a huge topic as quickly as I could.
Chat it in there, guys. There's hopefully a new few little tips there you got from BK. That's some awesome stuff. I want you to get to, if at all possible, Philip, in the time today, I really want you to get into that pay history and the mindset that you have. And then if we need to continue this, because obviously this is a big part of what we're doing on the 8th and 9th at the workshop, you know, going through
part three.
These files. Yeah, part three, but for sure, I know we've got two full days at the workshop as well that we're going through a lot of this stuff as well, but maybe just give them a high level on that as well. So go ahead.
Okay. So, like one of the last things I do is I always capture the socials. I always capture how many times they bounced a check, because that becomes important, and I capture their two most common reasons for default. As far as their ability and their willingness to pay, those are judgment calls I make. The occupancy status I should have, and then the strategy screen is where I advise, you know, our group or whomever I'm doing this work for, this is what I think you should do with this loan. And you should have something like that for yourself too. You should. It's very beneficial to actually type out what you're going to do with the loan, because it kind of makes you accountable to go ahead and do it. So Travis a little while ago asked, you know, what's one of the more relevant pieces of information when you're looking at these? Well, it's this pay history right here. I built this so that, these other columns, C and D and E, are not relevant because they read this way. This is just, this pulls in all the different loan numbers I may be reviewing at the time. So I've just built a bunch of little formulas here. You can see up here, it tells me how many payments I should have received in any period of time, how much is going to principal, how much is going to interest, to the escrow element, what that total should be. And then it'll tell me, you know, it very quickly tells me what I need to know about the payment. And then I'm very frequently looking for how many of the last 12 to 13 payments did somebody make. And as I'm going through a pay history, like this one, we got very, very rudimentary information from the seller on this one. And you can see they've noted that in this month, which they did not assign a calendar month name to, they received one payment. And this one they received two, and you can see it comes out to, you know, they received 11 payments or what have you. Then over here, they provided what the amounts of those payments were, and you can see that they vary. This one was this one was that, and they changed. I take that information and I use it in my own here, because it will help me extrapolate down here a full context of a pay history. The hows and the reasons, or the hows and the whys, aren't really that relevant. All you really are trying to understand is how many payments have they made out of the last 12 to 13, whatever your window is, and how much did that money equate to? So you can see here, you know, they paid almost $1,000 a month. And it's important to know how that came, because their payment amount is 963. So in theory, you can see, well, they've made all of their payments in the last 12. But they really didn't, because they missed one here, and they made it up here. And they missed one here, and they missed one here, and then they made the current one plus these two here. That's very important to know, because now, over the last 6 months, I can see they've made 8 payments, but 3 times I received 0 cash. Same thing with, you know, this one here. Yeah, they made 13 payments, but 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 months, I received 0 cash. And if you want to look at the last 6, you can see, you know, 3 out of the last 6 months, I received 0 cash. Now, it's up to you to decide, is it okay that they paid once here, twice here, 0, 0, 0, twice? That's for you to decide. But you have to understand, just because they made 13 payments, that, again, going back to no single point of data tells the whole story, this single point of data doesn't tell the whole story. This one, look at that, that's clockwork, right on through every time. This one, you know, they've made 11 payments, but they were very, very scattered. So that's why your pay history is one of the most important things you need to know. You want to know how many times they made a full payment and how much that equated to, because it could have been more than the minimum payment to roller due date, and the pattern of which they paid. Any questions on that?
None are coming in right now.
Pure gold, because it's pure gold, can clearly explain, and everybody should love it.
I got a quick comment here, guys, because I remember, you know, I've invested a decent chunk of change trying to get educated and get up to speed as quickly as possible. And this particular training today, yes, there's a lot of details, but this is something I've yet to participate in. Literally, I mean, we've had bits and pieces of it, but literally until now, you know, where it's been presented and gone through in a scenario like that, where you can really take things to the next level and do some of this. And so anyway, I'm excited, and you know, we had lots of questions coming in, and then I just was wondering if everyone stopped to eat their lunch or something, you know, because they fell off. So let us know if you guys are still on the line, right? I asked earlier if anyone thought that there were a few more fields, and any stuff that they got from that. It was good, you know, see if they got any more additional due diligence tips for their own investing. And we had one person answer, so maybe you guys are like watching your show on the other monitor or something. So let me know if you're in here, guys. This is great stuff if you're trying to create some cash flow.
So those are the high points of the data. I can typically make a pretty good decision based on everything that we looked at here. And again, this stuff over here, this is the seller's data they provided to us. Normally, I would actually see a pay history itself. I was very pleased to see that they went ahead and put this together. It's a little bit rudimentary, but it was able to be validated nonetheless. And then, so when we're doing due diligence for folks who are buying from us, we're looking at an enormous amount. You can see how many columns I have that aren't showing here, because there's so many other pieces of information that we go through and we analyze and we scrutinize that can't really be covered in the time that we have today. But rest assured, there's probably another 65 data points that we're analyzing very, very closely to make sure that we know what's going on. You can see we've got some discharged bankruptcies. We got one that was dismissed. This one was not reaffirmed. This one was secured. Let's see. So here's another really important piece of information. I don't know if anybody, I don't know if I covered it too quickly, but back over here, we had a bunch of this escrow information, okay, whether or not it was escrowed, and the balances. Let me show you why these are important with this and this as well. Because on these particular, just these few files, they're going to be sending us another $13,000, almost $650 a file. And when you look at the actual balances of these, so, I mean, that's a lot of money based on percentages. And it's the sum of what they have sitting in suspense, the sum of an advance that they can't recover from a trust or the borrower, or I'm sorry, from the trust, what they can recover from the borrower, and the late charges. The borrower owes you the late charges. Now, it's not really cash that's coming to you, right? You're going to inherit a balance that they owe you. This was not part of the unpaid principal balance that we bid on. But we were able to get these, we were able to inherit these as part of the trade because we knew to ask for them. And you guys should ask for these balances. And here's how you ask the question. Am I going to be assuming your escrow and recoverable or advanced balances? And now, just between you and me, I don't know how many people are out there, I wouldn't ever ask this question until you've established your price. I would ask that way down the line.
Did you guys get that? That's a little golden nugget right there. That's a little golden nugget because they've given their price based on that value.
Right. And the price is almost always based on the principal balance alone. But you can see here, we added $3,500 to... We added 3.5% to this balance. And that's a lot of money just because we asked. So you can see there's $13,000 more coming. And that's because the due diligence, the homework that we do when we're reselling loans, we uncover every single angle of every single data point. There's nothing that goes uncovered.
Nothing, Philip? Nothing? That's amazing.
Well,
I love it. Other questions, guys? I'm combing through here. It looks like we've answered some of them. People are asking, Philip, for the spreadsheet. We knew that would come. So we'll take care of you guys.
We can provide a variation of that, but for sure, and get you some of the data points.
Hey, real quick, can you just summarize one more time, Philip, on the, so after you've negotiated price, so negotiate your price first, then the question you're asking on for that extra $13,000?
I would like to inherit your recoverable balances, and all escrow balances, including suspense. And just make it sound like you know that's what they're supposed to do. I'm telling you, they won't just volunteer that stuff. Again, not because it's cash. They don't have that cash sitting in the bank. But they do have it on a balance sheet that they can take as a charge. There's a financial incentive for them to leave that money sitting on a balance sheet. So ask for it. And again, it's not cash, but guess what it is? It's a negotiation tool. You think any borrower in the world wants to pay $3,000 in late charges? Well, gosh, Mr. Borrower, I'll tell you what. Let's put you on a plan. You come up with a reasonable amount down. We'll get you back activated, and after that, you know, after the plan's over, I'll go ahead and waive those charges. I won't put them into the back of the loan. I won't add them to your balance. They will disappear completely. What do you think of that, Mr. Borrower? These are negotiating tools. Every single one of those columns is money that somebody paid on the borrower's behalf. Some of these are, you know, these are all very low, but it's very frequent to see balances in the thousands of dollars because they've been in foreclosure multiple times. Well, the borrower has to pay for that. They have to pay the services attorney to foreclose on them. And I can tell you, we've talked about moral opposition. That's one of the biggest ones. Nobody wants to pay the attorney to foreclose on them. So you use it as leverage in a negotiation because it's not real cash to you.
Very good. Any other questions, guys, before we wrap up for the day? BIPs, got a question mark on what are BIPs, basis points. You got that? Do you want to take that one? Gary's at the same time kicking back. Okay.
It was about, you know, unsecured, foreclosed loans or whatever, you know, factoring that in. You know, one strategy you could do is rather than kicking them back, proposing taking them off their hands for free, ideally, or for, you know, or for literally, you know, a fraction of a penny, which is dealing in basis points, referred to as BIPs.
And so, if you guys think that isn't possible, if you think a seller isn't willing to do that, how many loans did we pick up this morning, Aaron, that fit exactly that criteria?
A lot.
A lot.
Well, good, guys. This is, we're just a little bit over time. But actually, let's take this one last question from Alan. Looks like a very good question to finish it off. How much of this data did the seller provide directly versus what you derived from files? That's a great ending question because I put the word to describe Philip and Aaron's efforts on this, and Kristen played a big part as well. But capital H on the word hustle, right? So why don't you just tell him a little bit on that, just answer that a little bit.
Well, I can assign a data value to it. When I'm doing a full audit, I can bill 10 files a day. I can do 10 files a day, start to finish, and that's about it. And that's about a 12-hour day. Beyond that, you start to make mistakes. You start to miss stuff. We did 144 in, I don't know, 4 days, something like that. The seller provided name, address, social. After we bugged them, they provided pay histories. Other than that, we went out and got all of the data ourselves.
So it's critical having tools and resources and vendors and other things to be able to do that. And you basically have a couple options. One is, you know, you've received underwriting and audits and site visits to be able to use those tools. Others require minimums and contracts. Some are pay-as-you-go. You know, you simply, and that would be, you know, one set of pricing. Or you just reach out to the various vendors and suppliers and pay their price of what they want without having to go through all the rigmarole of, you know, doing what I just previously mentioned. There's some stuff that we can provide, although it's not the business that we want to be in. You know, if you're wanting some skip trace reports or, after you fund it and show us, you know, proof that you own and the collateral, or help with credit reports, we can do some of that. We have underwriting permission for that, and I think you already know that, but just restating that just in case. But very good.
There's one.
So I thought I'd throw my comment.
No, I appreciate that. There's one last question here, and it's a great lead-in to really what we're planning on for our October workshop. And, you know, of 190 fields, yeah, they all make up some part of the due diligence, but, you know, which ones, if you can't get to them all, or, you know, which ones are the money fields, you know, which are the things you're really looking at in terms of getting things done. And I know that's a big part of what we're going to be covering at the October workshop, is saying, okay, here's the absolute, you know, must need to know field. And so just to answer that, we'll be getting into that on October 8th and 9th. That's going to be a major part of, you know, just before you buy, what do you need to know? We're not going to know it all the time pre-funding. Post-funding, there's going to be some additional things that you'll just want to know as you fill that out. So great lead-in on that. So we hope all you guys can join us live. And if not, you know, the recordings will be amazing as always. But
hey, Travis.
So, yes, go ahead.
Did you want me to answer that, or was that a tease?
What I'd probably say is, why don't you give it a high-level answer, but I know we're going to be, I mean, literally, that's the theme, that's our agenda.
Okay.
For the workshop, that's a big part of it. But if you feel like you've got a high-level answer, go for it.
So if somebody told me you only can understand one data point and you have to decide yes or no, what's that data point? To me, it's the pay history.
That's a cliffhanger. What is it?
It's to be continued.
I interrupted you. What was it?
For me, it would be the pay history. And here's why. This business is about cash flow. If you're cash flowing, your equity position is less important. If you're cash flowing, everything else is less important. A lot of people are highly concerned about equity, and you should be, right? But if it's cash flowing, that's why you're in the business. So that's the decision that's what I would make my decision on if I could only pick one data point.
Golden nugget, dropping value bombs for the last 90 minutes, Mr. Philip Pay. Thank you, sir. We appreciate this today. And we are very excited to have you in town on the 8th and 9th of October, the 7th, 8th and 9th, I should say. And we hope all you guys can join us. And we appreciate you guys being on today. Anything else before we sign off, guys?
Yeah, just one other comment. Thanks for bearing with, you know, us on the loans and everything else. We've had several inquiries. Please keep them coming. You can email them directly over to any one of us, but if you want to send them over to Aaron at CapstoneFundingGroup.com, that'd be great. Our time and resources have been tied up with this trade so we can do this, because we'd like to, you know, offer in some blends of performing assets. A good chunk of this portfolio is a performing portfolio, and so I think you'll be really pleased with some of the results and things that we'll be putting in front of you guys. So we look forward to that very much.
One last thing before signing off, guys. I know we've got some of you still left here on the call. If there's anyone, there's a group of just a couple of very seasoned performing first mortgages with a great deal of equity coverage in Las Vegas and Nevada. And I personally, like, we've been looking at it, and we want to figure out how to take both loans down because they're a package. We're set to actually buy one of them, but if someone else is interested, just reach out to me via email. The total purchase is in the $340,000 range, and but just that's for both notes. But just get a hold of me if that's something you're interested in, and we can talk specifically about that particular deal. Nice little deal directly with a lender. So anyway, we'll talk soon. We'll see you guys on next week, on next week's training, and we look forward, if you guys have any other questions for us as it relates to this training, please shoot them over via email and we'll go from there. Signing off for today, guys. Hopefully this was helpful, and let us know if it is, and if there's things that you enjoyed, and please reach out to us and let us know what you liked, what else you'd like to see. That's a big part of how we structure these trainings. So thanks a lot, and we'll see you next week.